And second is, tastvamasi, you are also that. So that the same reality resides in you, I am that reality. The song that I shall sing by Kabir is that your Lord is within you. Just as there is perfume in the flower, which is intangible, we have been talking about it. You can experience it, but you can't hold it. You can hold the petal, you can appreciate the color, feel the texture, see the beautiful form the flower has. But where is the perfume? We don't know. There is perfume, all pervading, but we don't know where it is actually. So just as there is perfume in the flower, so are you, so is reality within you. Do not go out in search of that reality outside. It is here near you. There is a way, and you are not able to see. Once again, the idea given in one of the Upanishads, that truth has been covered over with a golden veil.
Yeah. Good morning. It's very difficult to realize that we have just begun and the seminar is going to come to a close tomorrow. And yet, we have much ground to cover. From this morning session, tomorrow, and the two sessions tomorrow, we are going to discuss a completely new subject, the subject with which we have not yet become familiar, but the subject which is most important. It is not a different subject. It is a movement in a different dimension. We are going to turn our attention to a new dimension of understanding. Not the dimension where we ordinarily function, but a completely different dimension. It is not easy to move from one dimension to the other, because the second dimension is not the extension of the previous dimension. One has to leave off, just as when one jumps, one cannot have one foot on the ground and the other foot high up. One has to leave the ground. That is the condition so far as the dimensional movement is concerned. We are going to go into the question of mysticism. This morning we shall discuss mysticism. This afternoon we will go into the question of meditation. Tomorrow morning we shall consider the question of the relationship between the manifest and the unmanifest. And tomorrow afternoon, the last session, it will be a session in musical discourse, so that what is talked about will be interspersed with music, and we shall concern ourselves with the writings and teachings of one of the great mystics, Kabir. And it is with this that we shall end this seminar, to meet again somewhere, sometime. We have been considering so far the question in terms of psychic development, extrasensory perception. This is what we talked about yesterday. But we are now talking about something which is completely different. Mysticism has been talked about in all religions. In fact, mysticism is the core of every religion. It is something which is at the center. All deep teachings of every religion are centered around that particular core, and that core is mysticism. If we go into this question, we will find that we exist in a universe which can be conceived of in terms of three layers. There are not layers, but since we have to understand with the help of the mind, we are using language, realizing that language itself is very incomplete. There is a universe which we cognize with our senses. That is the sensorial experience, the sensorial universe. We are able to cognize it. We are able to respond to it in terms of the senses. In other words, it is the universe that can be cognized, that can be understood. The second category of the universe is, there is one layer of that universe which I cannot understand. I cannot, because I do not have the necessary means. I do not possess the necessary instruments. And that is the universe which we have called the psychic universe, the extrasensory universe, the occult universe. Call it by whatever name you like. And therefore there is a universe which I cannot understand. But there is a third layer, and with regard to that third layer we can say, there is a universe which can be cognized, which can be understood, which can be seen, but I do not see it. The second category is the universe which I cannot see. The first is the sensorial universe which we can cognize with the senses. But the third layer about which I am speaking is, it is a universe here and now in front of me. I can see it, I can experience it, but I do not see it, I do not experience it. It is to this universe. Why is it that even though it is in front of me, I do not see it? Why? What is the obstacle? What is the obstruction, so that even though it is in front of me, here and now, why is it that I am not able to see? And therefore, the universe which cannot be seen and the universe I do not see, these are the two categories of the universe. We will not talk about the universe that we cannot see, but we are talking of the universe which we do not see. We have the eyes. We have all the perceptive agencies. It is possible for us to experience that universe, but we do not. That is the unfortunate position, and it is with this that mysticism is concerned. Mysticism is not some mystification, something that is lost in the air, something that is vague, something that is not precise. That is not mysticism. Mysticism is something which can be cognized, provided we are ready to see it, provided we are ready to experience it, but we are unable to see because we do not want to see. It is not that we have not the capacities. We have the capacity. I can experience it, but I do not experience it. Why? Why has this come into existence? We will have to go into it. The subject that is put in the program is the mystical approach, the East and the West. I would like to point out that there is no Eastern mysticism and there is no Western mysticism. The mystical experience is neither East nor West. The mystical experience is something which cannot be defined in terms of the East and the West. It is true that when the mystical experience is sought to be expressed, then the language is different, the jargons are different, the similes are different. It is only then we come to the East and the West. There is the expression which is fundamentally Eastern. There is an expression which is fundamentally Western. With regard to expression, one can speak about East and the West. But with regard to the experience, the mystical experience, it is neither East nor West. It transcends all our classifications into which we are lost all the time. This mysticism, as it was understood in Eastern countries, I'm talking of the Eastern countries because our subject, our main theme is the fundamentals of Hindu psychology, the fundamentals of ancient psychology. And so we will just take a note of what the Eastern countries, what Hinduism has talked about so far as mysticism is concerned. We shall see what mysticism is in terms of the Western countries too. In the East, particularly in the background of Hinduism, we have to understand that there are a number of scriptural texts. There is not one, so that you accept one, you read it, you commit it to memory, you accept it. There is no one scriptural text. In fact, in Hinduism, there are various scriptural texts, starting from the Vedas. There are the four Vedas. And each Veda is divided into four sections. The four sections are, first of all, mantra. Just the recitation of certain aphorisms, recitation of certain phrases, recitation of certain words. That is the first part, so far as the Vedas are concerned. The second part of the Vedas are known as the Brahmanas. Brahmanas means they are concerned with rituals and with ceremonies. Number of rituals and number of ceremonies are given in the Vedas, in that part of the Vedas. The third part of each Veda, there are the four Vedas, and the third part of each Veda is what is known as Aranyaka. In Aranyaka, Aranyaka means that part of the Veda which is meant for the forest dwellers, who have gone to the forest, who have not completely retired, but who have taken shelter in the forest. Forest not to be understood in the literal sense, but who have moved away from the daily avocations and are now free to turn to the deeper aspects of life. And this aspect is known as Aranyaka, where you will find deep philosophical discussions. Deep philosophical discussions on matters, different matters of life. That is the third part of the Veda. And the fourth part of each Veda is Upanishad. Upanishad is the spiritual discussions, not just the intellectual, but the spiritual part of the Vedas you find in the Upanishads. And there are many Upanishads. But one might say that there are 10 or 11 major Upanishads. There are any number of minor Upanishads, more than 100. But there are 10 or 11 major Upanishads. In these Upanishads, there is discussed something which is of a spiritual nature. If you want to contact Hindu mysticism, mysticism as it is couched in Hindu terminology, then you will find that the Upanishads are the fountainhead of Hindu mysticism. They are by and large books concerned with the mystical aspect. If you want to know what the mysticism of the Hindus is, then that mysticism can be found in Upanishads. Beautiful. But you will find that these Upanishads leave certain things unexpressed. In fact, as one reads Upanishads, one is reminded of that English poet who said, "Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter." The heard melodies are sweet. The Upanishads do not merely speak about the heard melodies, but about the unheard melodies. We are concerned in mysticism with that which is unheard, that which is unexpressed. It is not possible to express it, and it is with this unexpressed that the Upanishads are concerned, because they are, as I said, the fountainhead of the mystical understanding of the Hindus. There are other texts apart from these Vedas and the Upanishads. There are the Smrutis. These are called the Shrutis. Upanishad is called Shruti. Shruti means a direct experience. That which has been conveyed by a direct experience, through a direct experience, that is what is called Shruti. There are the Smrutis. Smrutis means, the very word Smruti means, that which has been remembered. Shruti is that which is directly experienced, and Smruti is that which is remembered. There are many Smrutis. In Smrutis there are the codification of laws, how the society should be governed, how the society should be organized, how the individual must live in that society. All that aspect of law, of ethics, of morality, of social morality, they are indicated in what are known as the Smrutis. The Upanishads, which are the Shruti, and the Smrutis, which are many, it is these that constitute, from one standpoint, the fundamental basis of Hinduism. Then there are the Itihasas, the history, the historical narrations. For example, you find in Ramayana and Mahabharata. Ramayana and Mahabharata, they are narrations of history from the earliest of times. What has happened in the history of the race, that is what is depicted in Ramayana and Mahabharata. This is also one category so far as the scriptural texts are concerned. There are the mythologies, which are known as the Puranas. There are more than 100 Puranas. These Puranas, they deal with mythologies, Hindu mythology. Just as you have the Greek mythology, similarly, there is the mythology of the Hindus, and these mythologies, they are more than history. These mythologies are depicted in what are known as the Puranas. There are, as I said, other scriptural texts. For example, there are the aphorisms, the sutra. The sutra literature is also one cultural legacy that the Hindus have received. And so when we speak of Hinduism, Hinduism is spread out in all these various aspects about which I have just now spoken. And it is only when you are conversant with some of them that you can say, yes, I understand what Hinduism is. Otherwise, it is not possible to know what Hinduism is. Because Hinduism is spread out in all these different expressions about which I have just now spoken. I'm referring to this because in the midst of all this, the mystical aspect of the Hindus, it is expressed and expressed in a beautiful manner in the Upanishads. You turn to Upanishad after Upanishad, and you will find that these Upanishads contain something which the mind of man cannot understand, which cannot be cognized by the functioning of intellect. And yet it strikes a note in the heart. This seems to be true. I cannot explain it. I cannot verbalize about it. I cannot really understand it in words. But this seems to be right. It is that feeling that arises because of the mystical statements that you find in the Upanishads. We were talking yesterday about the psychic experience, about the superphysical experience. The superphysical experience is, by and large, constituted by what is called occultism. Occultism, the word occultism, the occult is the hidden, something that is hidden. Something that is hidden because I cannot go deep into it, because I do not have the necessary instruments by which I can understand, ordinarily understand, the occult aspect of things. This is occultism. Occultism is something which I cannot understand by the capacities that I have. I must develop fresh capacities. But mysticism is that which I can understand, which I can see, but I don't. And we want to go into the question, why is it that even though it is in front of me, I do not see it? Mysticism is in front of us. Mysticism is the simplest of things. But why are we not able to understand this mysticism? Because of the high conditioning under which we exist. It is the conditioning. And that is why the mysticism has always said, leave aside your conditioning completely, without any reservation whatsoever. Be completely unconditioned. And when you are completely unconditioned, then only you can understand what is in front of you. This unconditioning is given expression to in the deeper aspects of all religion. You have the story of the rich young man in the Christian literature, the rich young man who went to Jesus and said, Lord, I've kept the commandments. What else shall I do? And Jesus said, sell all thou hast and follow me. Sell all thou hast. We are not prepared to do it. We are prepared to sell a few things which I don't want. But I don't want to sell things which I think I shall need it. But here Jesus says, sell all thou hast and follow me. There is no other condition. This is the condition laid down, and such is the conditions that are laid down in all the great religions of the world. Go to Buddhism. When a young man went to the Zen master and said, Master, please tell me about the deeper aspects of Zen. The master did not say anything. Again the pupil repeated, Sir, tell me the deepest aspects of Zen. Even then the master did not speak. And the pupil was impatient. Pupil said, well, sir, why don't you say, why don't you tell me? Then the teacher said, but how can I tell you? You have come full of all concepts, ideas, imaginations. Your mind is full. There is no space at all in your mind for the teaching which you want to understand. And therefore, first of all, wipe away everything, completely wipe away everything, and then come. Then I shall be able to talk to you about Zen, the deeper aspects of Zen. If you turn to the Bhagavad Gita, the same idea is to be found in the Bhagavad Gita. Sarva dharman parityaj. Give up all the commitments of the mind. Dharma is the commitment. Give up all the commitments of the mind. Sarva dharman parityajya. Mamekam sharanam raja. Come to me. Come to me, nothing that is brought. Come to me completely empty-handed. Completely empty-handed. Then I shall be able to deal with the problems with which you are faced today. And therefore you will find this idea to be found everywhere. This is the core of every religion. Core of every religion. At the core of every religion, it is mentioned that you are a conditioned individual. Remove all the conditioning. All the conditioning. And face me without any conditioning that you have brought. Then you will be able to understand. Our difficulty is that it can be seen and yet we do not see. Why do we not see? The obstacle is not placed by anybody else. The obstacle is self-created because I go to the door of reality with a conditioned consciousness. And because I go to reality with a conditioned consciousness, I am not able to understand it. The reality, as it were, tells us, be free from all conditioning. All, absolutely, without an exception, be free from all conditioning. But this is the great difficulty. And the mysticism, the way of mysticism, is that way where one discovers the secret of being absolutely unconditioned. This conditioning is very much spoken about these days. In fact, all students of psychology speak about this conditioning. We say, observe yourself. And if you observe yourself, you will be free here and now. But the question is, who is going to observe? Because observation denotes observer. Who is going to observe? And we say, I am going to observe. But we have discussed in the earlier days who this I is. The observer is the most conditioned entity. And therefore, when the observer himself is conditioned, and if the observer is going to observe, what can he observe? What he observes is only the projections of his own conditioning. And therefore, so long as the observer is present, there can be no observation whatsoever. Just as J. Krishnamurti very rightly says, so long as the meditator is present, there can be no meditation whatsoever. Because it is the meditator which is creating obstacles. And therefore, it is the observer, the perceiver who is creating difficulties. So long as the perceiver is there, so long there is no possibility of real perception, of unconditioned perception. And therefore, it is easy to speak about observation, observe. But unless and until we go into the question, who is the observer? And who is going to remove the observer? And who is going to remove the observer? This is a very mysterious question into which we will not go just now. We shall do it during the four sessions that we still have, that how can this observer be eliminated? Because unless and until the observer is eliminated, there is no possibility of observation. This is the problem with which modern physics is faced. Because modern physics says that in every act of perception, the perceiver is involved. And therefore, unless I remove the perceiver, it will not be possible for me to see, to perceive. This is the difficulty that you find in the writings of some of the eminent scientists. And they say, we do not know how to remove the perceiver. You cannot know how to remove the perceiver unless you have come to the understanding, the deeper understanding of mysticism. Because it is mysticism that is concerned with perfect observation, where the observer does not exist at all. The removal of the observer is absolutely necessary because without the removal of the observer, your observation is a conditioned observation. It is only your projection, and since it is your own projection, You are seeing your projections, you are not seeing what is. And therefore, mysticism is concerned with this. We are unable to see because we are highly conditioned individuals. Culture has conditioned us, education has conditioned us, the social atmosphere has conditioned us, our past has conditioned us. And so we move like conditioned individuals, heavily conditioned, and therefore we are not able to see what is. It is in front of me, but I am not able to see because of the conditioning which I have brought. And among these conditionings, the greatest aspect of conditioning is be conditioned by my past. I cannot be free from my past. I bring that past. I may express that past in different ways. You will find, if you turn to that very fine book of the scientist Sheldrake, Sheldrake has written, Sheldrake wrote some years ago the book, The Science, The New Science of Life. That was the title of his book. But the second book, the bigger book, is The Past is Present. The Presence of the Past. The Presence of the Past, that is the title of the book. The past is all the time present with us. And it is the presence of the past which is one of the major conditioning factors so far as our life is concerned. Can I be freed from the past? Because if I have to face reality, and reality puts this demand, come to me removing everything, sarvadharman parityajya, all your commitments, all the commitments of the mind, leave aside, don't come to me with any commitments whatsoever, sell all thou hast, without any exception, sell all thou hast, and come to me. These are the injunctions that you find in all the great religions of the world. The question of questions is, how are we going to be unconditioned? Because any effort to decondition or uncondition ourselves is a fresh conditioning. Is it possible for us with a conscious effort of the mind to decondition ourselves? It is not, because the mind puts new conditioning. And therefore, we get rid of one conditioning, one type of conditioning, and we get involved into another conditioning. Is it possible by the mind, through its conscious effort, to be free from conditioning? And if it is not, then what are we to do? We are faced with a difficult situation for which there is no solution in terms of the mind and its efforts. It is this question which is discussed in mysticism. In mysticism, these are the problems that are discussed. In Upanishads, which are, as I said, the storehouse of Hindu mysticism, there are various stories. And these stories are very, very illuminating. Once Narada, a mythological figure of Hinduism, Narada, a very learned man, Narada went to the Lord and said, Lord, I have acquired much knowledge, but I have not yet come to the silence of the mind. Please teach me how to come to the silence of the mind. Then the Lord said, Narada, you say that you have learned many things. You have acquired much knowledge. But what is your knowledge? What have you learned? And Narada gives a long list. I have studied this. Long list of subjects. And Narada thought the Lord would be greatly impressed by this achievement, by the gathering of all this knowledge. The Lord listened to him. And the Lord said, Narada, remember, what you call knowledge is nothing but the collection of words and names. That is all that you have done. The knowledge about which we are proud, these are nothing but collection of words and names. And the Lord said to Narada, it is only when you go beyond words and names that it will be possible for you to know what the silence is. It is then that you will come to the experience of silence. You must go beyond words and names. We have collected many names, we have collected many words, and we call this collection as our knowledge. In fact, we have to understand distinction between three things. One is information. By and large, we call information as knowledge. We have gathered information and we have gone on collecting information. This information we call knowledge. We have information about God, we have information about reality, because we have read so much, and therefore we say we know. We do not know, we have only collected information. This information has to be transformed into knowledge. But how can information be transformed into knowledge? It can be transformed into knowledge when I am open, when I have a wider outlook, when I am ready to collect more and more of the viewpoints of other people. He who is open to the viewpoints of others, he goes on collecting viewpoints, and not the narrow collection with which he goes. He who widens his understanding, widens his outlook, by this widening process, it is possible for him to transform information into knowledge. We are going only by information, because we have read books, we have memorized books, and by books we go on reeling out that information, and the reeling out of that information we call knowledge. It is not knowledge. Information has to be transformed into knowledge. Make it wider. Try to collect information from those sources which are apparently against your particular commitment. Find out what others have to say. You believe in God, somebody else does not believe in God. Collect. Why does he not believe in God? And therefore, he who is open, he is not just committed to what he has read, but he who is open, all the time open, he will be able to transform information into knowledge. But that is not enough. The knowledge that we have arrived at must be transformed into wisdom. It must become wisdom. Mere knowledge is not enough. It must become wisdom. And when is knowledge transformed into wisdom? When the knower is eliminated, when there is no knower at all. So long as the knower is there, there is a certain amount of conditioning. When the knower goes, when the seer, when the perceiver goes, it is only then that wisdom is arrived at. And mysticism is concerned with the elimination of the perceiver, the elimination of the seer, the elimination of the I. And our constant difficulty is, if the I is removed, then who remains? It's nothingness. And therefore, we are afraid of this nothing. I don't want to be nothing. I don't want to face nothing. Because we are committed to something. What is this something? In one of the Upanishads, there is a story of a man, the earlier man, the first man as it were, who started becoming afraid. Fear arose in his mind. And he said, why? So long I was not afraid, why is it that fear has come into my life? What is the reason of this fear? And he said, yes, I'm afraid because I'm alone. But if you are alone, of whom are you afraid? He argued further that if I am alone, of whom am I afraid? He said, no, this is not the answer. Then he goes further, and there the Upanishad, in one of the very short statements, gives the answer. And the answer is, dvitiyad vai bhayam bhavati. It is only when there is a duality that you are afraid. If there is no duality, you cannot be afraid. It is duality that causes this sense of fear. I and somebody else, and I'm afraid of that somebody else. And therefore, mysticism, whether of the Upanishads or of the Western mold, mysticism is by and large concerned with that non-dual experience. Not the dual experience, but the non-dual experience. The Upanishads, the 11 Upanishads, one after the other, they discuss this question of non-duality. It is a consciousness, a higher state of consciousness. Our consciousness is consciousness of duality. We function in the field of duality. Duality is the only field in which we are able to act. But here, the mysticism speaks of that state of consciousness which is a non-dual state. Not a dual state, but non-dual state. Because so long as there is the duality, then there is a conflict. So long as there is duality, there is an effort to synthesize. There is an effort to compromise. But when there is no duality, there is, as it were, no movement of consciousness at all. Consciousness comes to a complete silence because there is no movement possible. And therefore mysticism, whether of the East or of the West, is fundamentally concerned with the non-dual consciousness. Not the consciousness of duality, but a non-dual consciousness. We are considering various aspects of consciousness. And when we come to mysticism, not the consciousness of duality, but a non-dual consciousness. We are considering various aspects of consciousness. And when we come to mysticism, we are in that non-dual concept of consciousness, non-dual experience of consciousness. So long as we talk of the sensorial experience is in the field of duality. There is the experiencer and there is the experienced. There is the subject and there is the object. There is the seer and there is the seen. There is the observer and that is the observed. That is the sensorial experience. But when you go to the supersensorial, when you go to the extrasensorial, the psychic or the occult, even there remains this duality of the perceiver and the perceived. The perceived has changed. There is a different scenery. There is a different setup so far as the perceived is concerned. But the perceiver is there, and therefore in all extrasensory experiences, all occult experiences about which we talk. And so that consciousness is a limited consciousness by the presence of this duality. It is only when we come to the consciousness of mysticism, the mystical consciousness, in the mystical consciousness, there is no duality whatsoever. We have come to that level of consciousness. We have come to that state of consciousness where duality absolutely has no validity whatsoever. It is an experience of non-duality. Of course, you may ask, then who experiences? We will go into this question because we have three more sessions in which to discuss these various aspects of mysticism. But first of all, we must realize the differentiation between our consciousness, whether sensorial or extrasensorial consciousness, and the consciousness which is denoted by mysticism. One glaring difference between the two is that in the earlier two states of consciousness, duality exists. In the mystical experience, there is no duality whatsoever. And as the Upanishad says, it is only when there is a duality that fear arises. I'm afraid because somebody will attack me. Somebody will take away something that I prize. Somebody will come and upset me. And therefore it is the presence of the other which is the cause of fear. That is what the mysticism says. But how can we remove the other? Can we remove the other? No, the other has no independent existence. I have created the other. I am the creator of the other. And therefore the problem is not to remove the other. The problem is to remove myself, to remove the I. The I that is the creator of the other. If this I could be removed, then the other will automatically go. The other will have no existence whatsoever. And therefore I will be free from the problem of fear or whatever may be the problem. I shall be completely free because there is no duality whatsoever. And therefore mysticism is concerned with the non-dual experience. It is a consciousness which can be characterized as the non-dual consciousness. and it is about the non-dual consciousness that you find all types of discussions in various schools of mysticism. Turn, for example, the crucifixion of Jesus. And Jesus said, it is told, the story goes, it says, Jesus said, my Father, why hast thou forsaken me? And so long as he said, my Father, why have you forsaken me? He was still under the control of this dual aspect. But when he said further, I and my Father are one, then it is that not only there was crucifixion, but there was a resurrection. In the midst of crucifixion, there was a resurrection. Not when Jesus said, Father, my Father, why hast thou forsaken me? Because when he said this, there was a duality. I and my Father has forsaken me. But when he came to the experience, I and my Father are one, then was the real expression of spirituality. That was the spiritual consciousness. That was the consciousness that was bereft of the touch of the dual. Whenever there is a duality, there is the fragmentation. And a fragmented consciousness is not a whole consciousness. And we all of us move about with a fragmented consciousness. And the fragmented consciousness creates fragmentation wherever it goes, division wherever it goes. And therefore we live in a world which we constantly divide, I and the other, my view and the other man's view, my concept and the other man's concept. There is a constant division. Why? Because the consciousness itself is fragmented. And since it is through consciousness that we look at life, all our perception of life is a fragmented perception. And in that fragmented perception, the living quality is completely missed. We may be clever, and we are clever. We can weave out many things. We can use many words. But behind all that, there is the experience of the fragmented consciousness. And therefore, whether you go to the East or you go to the West, mysticism means the experience of the whole. It is this experience of the whole which is the characteristic so far as the Upanishads are concerned. The Upanishadic philosophy, the approach of Upanishad, is the approach of the whole, not the approach of a fragment. One of the earliest of the Upanishads, which is known as the Ishavasya Upanishad, in that Upanishad, the opening verse very clearly says, and it strikes the very note of the Upanishadic teaching, the teaching of all the Upanishads. It says, the whole is whole. The whole remains the whole. If you take away everything, still the whole remains. If you add to it, even then the whole remains. It strikes the note of this wholeness. Totality is not like that. When you take away from totality, then there is a diminution, something less, so far as totality is concerned. But whole is whole. Even if you take away everything, even then the whole remains. In other words, the whole is present even in the tiniest of parts. Tiniest of parts. But it is very difficult for us to understand this whole because of the conditioning of consciousness. Sri Aurobindo says at one place very beautifully, he says, the secret of lotus cannot be found by analyzing the mud in which it grows. You may go on analyzing the mud, but by analyzing the mud, you will not be able to find out the secret of the lotus. It grows in mud, but still the secret is not there. Then where is the secret of the lotus? It is this which the mystic is interested in finding out. Where is the secret of lotus? Where is the secret of man? Is it in the analysis of the mud? That is what psychologists used to do. When we were full of the Freudian psychology, we were lost in analysis. Analysis of the subconscious. And the analysis of the subconscious was like analyzing mud. But we may go on analyzing as much as we like, whether it is unconscious, subconscious, whatever it is. Whenever we analyze, it is not by analysis that it is possible for us to come to the understanding of the secret of the beauty of lotus. It is somewhere else. Where is it? It's a mystery. And yet lotus is beautiful. And by analyzing the mud, you cannot find the secret. It is somewhere else. Where is it? It is here and now. If you can commune with the lotus will be able to tell you what the secret is. But we have lost the art of communing with the lotus. In fact, this whole art of communing is completely lost. We have many, many means of communication, but we do not know what commune is. We do not know each other. We have neither communed with ourselves, nor have we communed with our neighbor, with our friend. We have talked to our friend. We have been with our friend. We have indulged in much talk. We have indulged in many words. We have communicated. But without communion, unless there is the ground of communion, all communication is useless. That communication has no value whatsoever. It is only in silence that this communion is possible. The two friends must meet in silence. But we have never met in silence. We have only met in the background of words, words and more words. There is a story of two scientists. One scientist invited another scientist to have dinner with him. And the other scientist went. And they were together for more than 2 hours. But not a word was spoken by the one to the other. Not a word was spoken. And when the scientist who had come, who had been invited, when he was about to leave, he said, "Oh, we had an enjoyable time." They had not exchanged one word, but he said, "We had an enjoyable time." It is the enjoyable time in silence. The difficulty with most of us is, with all of us is, we have not known what silence is. We are afraid of that silence. We do not want to face that silence. When there is the moment of silence, then there must be TV, there must be newspaper, there must be chattering, there must be something there, because I do not want to face myself. I do not want to face what silence brings us. But so long as we are afraid of silence, we cannot understand. It is he who is able to face this silence. It is he who knows the secret of the unconditioning of consciousness. Mysticism, by and large, is concerned with the language of silence, not the language of words, the language of science. And we shall go into it as we move further. What is this language of silence? Because we are going to discuss how the unmanifest communicates with the manifest. What is the relationship between the manifest and the unmanifest? We are going to go into the question of meditation, because whether you talk of meditation or you talk of this communication of the unmanifest with the manifest, or you talk of that subject which we call spirituality, all these fundamentally are concerned with the experience of silence. Consciousness has not known what silence is. We shall see what this silence can convey, what is the experience of this silence. Into the depth of this silence we shall try to go in the course of the subsequent talks. We shall have a break. Yes? I couldn't follow what.
Who is the Lord whom Narada asked?
The Lord, the name is Sanat Kumar. But how does it concern any of us? It may be Sanat Kumar, it may be anybody. It may be John, it may be Charles. It doesn't matter who he is. The question is the reply that came. And the reply was that it is only when you go beyond words and names that you will know what the silence is, because you are in search of silence, which you have not found, because you are lost in words and names, and therefore go beyond it. Here the Lord was Lord Sanat Kumar. Who creates noise? Obviously, it is the mind that creates noise. And therefore, when the noisemaker is silent, then there is silence. It is you and I who make noise. And therefore, when this I, the movement of the I, for the time being, is not there, then there is the experience of silence. But the question will be how to see that this noisemaker is not there. But that we shall go into the question when we turn to meditation and the rest of this portion. Because meditation is concerned primarily with the seeing that the meditator is not there. It is the meditator who creates noise, and that is why we are distracted. Our distraction is not from outside. Our distraction is from ourselves. And therefore, if there could be the cessation of that distraction, then we know what silence is. Yes? He was in duality, whether how can he be, that's an argumentation. He was in fear, and he said, I'm afraid, that's all. How can you challenge his statement? If I say I'm afraid, I know that I'm afraid. We cannot go into who the original man was, where the male and the female, we have not gone into the male and female consciousness at all. The original man, because the mind started functioning, and when the mind started functioning, since mind creates duality, he was in the midst of duality. And because there was duality, he was afraid, because duality always causes fear. Yes? By extra senses, we don't mean more than five senses. We are not talking of any extra, sixth sense or seventh sense. Extrasensorial means beyond the cognition of the senses. The five senses that we have, which cannot be cognized by the five senses, is extrasensorial. And therefore, by extra, we mean something that is beyond the operative field of the five senses. Something with the senses cannot cognize. I cannot see something with the eyes, hear with the ears, or with the other senses. Some experience which transcends the cognitive field of these five senses is extrasensorial. That is what the Hindu psychology means by extrasensorial. Yes? There is much confusion so far as chakras are concerned. In fact, there is very little sensible that is written so far as chakras are concerned. Chakras are not the extra senses. Chakras are certain fields, not within the body. It doesn't form part of the body at all. These chakras are the indicators that probably at these places it will be possible for you to contact that etheric realm about which the chakras speak, because chakras are not physical. They are certain force centers at the etheric level. And therefore, as I said, very little has really sensible written so far as chakras is concerned, and therefore it would not be advisable for us to go into this question of the chakras. That is why I said, you forget it, because the arousal of Kundalini by stimulating the chakras is not only not clearly understood, but it is a dangerous process, because you may be releasing certain forces which you do not know what those forces are. And therefore it is better that it is left aside and we talk of the direct arousing of Kundalini, forgetting the chakras. Yes? There are any number of books. There is the book by C.W. Leadbeater on chakras, and there are any number of books. The tantric literature is full of information about chakras. Yes, there is vast literature on tantra, all tantric literature deals with chakras. Yes. Yes, we need communication. We need communication by words, by gestures. But silence that I am speaking about is a ground in which our communication becomes more effective. If we have communed with each other in silence, then the word that will emerge, which is the method of communication, it will be far more effective than the case otherwise is. In fact, we have never experienced each other's company in silence for the time being. If we do, then much of our unnecessary talk will cease, and we will be able to communicate with each other with greater effectiveness. But we have not gone into the nature of silence, we have just used the word silence. Because there is silence which comes with the cessation of noise, with the cessation of words. But there is a silence which is in the midst of noise. And when we talk of deeper silence, we are talking of that silence. So that even when the noise is going on, even in that noise, intangibly, silence is present. Because silence is really the ground in which creation takes place. And therefore, there can be silence with the cessation of words, or there can be silence in the midst of the words. But since that is more difficult, we begin by that experience of silence which arises with the cessation of outer noise. First of all, there must be the cessation of outer noise. Then we shall go into the question of the cessation of inner noise, the noise made by our thinking. And therefore, there are these two aspects of silence. But silence is regenerative. Nature regenerates in the silence of the night. You and I also can find our regeneration if we have experience of silence. But since we are strangers to silence, we do not know of the regenerative process at all. We do not allow the regenerative process to function.
Let's say you spoke about the possibility of having 20 senses. for which we have left only five.
I don't know what those 15 senses are. It is one scientist who has written that there are 20 senses. But I don't know, and I don't bother to know, because it is very difficult to deal with five senses. If there are 20 senses, it will become more difficult. Of course, in the Hindu books, mind is also regarded as sense. Manasastu, among the senses, mind is the sense. That is what is stated in one of the Hindu scriptures. But as I said, I really do not know what the other 20 senses are, or the 15 senses are, and I am not very much interested in knowing. Yes. But even those who are not mystics, they have been killed. Abraham Lincoln was not a mystic, but he was killed. And so it is not that the mystics are killed. Anybody who is not convenient to the other person, that person is put out. The killing goes on. And therefore it is not something which is restricted to mystics. Yes. Mystics did not act back. I'm not quite able to. The mystics did not reply, did not respond, did not react. So what? I'm not quite able to understand what your question is. What? Not to react. Yes, but what is man's survival? In fact, we must go into the question, what is death? Is death the end of everything? Then what does it matter? If a person is put out on one plane, he still exists on the other plane. But in the West also it is beginning to be realized that death is not the end. There is a vast literature written by the Western thinkers on the problem of death, the survival after death. These are the questions that are being discussed. It is no longer the prerogative of the Indian or the Eastern, but it is coming into the West. It is being recognized more and more. I'm not suggesting that you must face death or you must invite death. I'm not suggesting. But why are we very much worried about this death? Because death is not the end. In fact, one can live only by dying. Dying to my accumulations, dying to my possessions. Death is the meaning of life. Without death, life has no meaning whatsoever. And therefore, I would not attach so much of importance so far as death is concerned.
But if you say you should not invite death,
when somebody tries to kill me, it's also an invitation to death. To say, oh, let me go, let me do so.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying this. Don't invite death, nor escape from death. Try to run away from death. When it comes, also, all right, face it. Yes?
Death is coming only if you allow to let that person kill you. But it is not necessary. So it is not
but I'm, that is why I'm saying I don't invite him. So what will you do? I'm asking you.
If it's possible in a normal way, I should say, then I should save my life.
So do it. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm not saying that don't save your life. If somebody wants to shoot you, try to run away from it. Or you shoot back. I'm not saying that don't shoot back.
But I think he says that Jesus let himself be crucified.
But why are you singling out Mahatma Gandhi? Abraham Lincoln was also shot down like that. There are so many people. Indira Gandhi, who was the Prime Minister of India, she was also shot. About what? But I'm saying is, if you can escape it, do escape it. I'm not saying that you invite death. You run away if you want. Or shoot back if you want. Quite right. That is most sensible. I would certainly say it's most sensible. If you can run away from death, by all means run away. There is no harm in it. No, I'm not. Yes? We are going to talk about the relationship of the unmanifest and the manifest. How does the unmanifest communicate with the manifest? And since there is one full hour devoted to it, I shall go into this question. Because surely the communication between the unmanifest with the manifest is the communication of the silence with the condition which is not silent. Because the unmanifest arises in silence. How does that silence communicate with manifestation which is full of noise? We shall go into it because there is language which is different for the communication by the unmanifest to the manifest. But we'll go into it as we are going to devote one full hour. Perhaps we will leave it for that. What is the nature of communication between the unmanifest and the manifest? It is very largely, and we have seen in history, that there have been periods when the communication was with symbols. Even our language is a symbol, but we forget. We think that the ancients were only dealing with symbols. We are also dealing with symbols. Our language is nothing but a symbol. And therefore, there is a language by symbols. The mythology of the world is full of this language of symbols, because there are certain things which you cannot communicate in words. Word is a symbol, but it is not an effective symbol. And that is why in mythology you find many, many symbols which have conveyed and communicated far more effectively than the communication that was possible only by words. But all communication is by symbols, yes? All communication is by symbols. Because you cannot communicate your experience. Experience is something which you have had. If the other person has not had that experience, then you can explain to the other person only in symbols. Whether your symbols are in words or in idols, in images, in stories, whatever it is. But symbol is the only way by which one can communicate. There is no other way. Oh, Lincoln. I don't know. I mean, it's not a very serious statement. If he was not mystic, I'm not worried. He was mystic, even then I'm not worried. But obviously he was a politician. He was not like Mahatma Gandhi or like other people, other mystics of the world. His life field was completely different. That is why I said he was not a mystic. He may have been a mystic, I don't know. No, it can be. I have been in politics. I have been 5 times to jail in prison. I have been imprisoned 5 times. And so you can't say that I run away from politics. I don't say that politics is something which is antagonistic to mystical experience. I am not saying that. But I don't feel like saying that Abraham Lincoln was a mystic. I may be wrong. If you say he was a mystic, I'm prepared to accept it. Yes. It is dangerous because when consciously through visualization, you create the conditions of pleasure, you would like to stay on in that pleasure. There would be indulgence. That is where the difficulty of Tantra arose in the past. Tantra has advocated this means of visualization, that visualize a pleasant moment. Visualize something in which you feel very happy. But as I said, give it up. Don't cling to it, give it up. Visualization that you have done, do not hold on to it. But in the past, the mistake that was committed by those who practiced this Tantra was, they held on to it. And when you hold on to it, then there is an indulgence. An indulgence in pleasure is something from which you cannot get out. You cannot get out for the purposes for which you had started that visualization. And that is why it is very necessary to create a visualized image, then drop it. Give it over, as I said, to the computer with the brain ease. It is this last section which has not been followed in the usual tantric practices. They hold on and hold on and hold on. And by holding on, they miss the particular point for which the visualization was done. That is the breathing which is known in the Hindu system as Brasrika Pranayama. As if you are going up the mountain, you are rising, and as you go little out of breath, and the breathing that takes place when you are bound to go out of breath, likely to go out of breath, it is that breathing which is described as Brasrika Pranayama. In that pranayama, in that particular aspect of pranayama, the energy that has been released can be preserved and not dissipated. This is only the technique. You can use any other technique if you like, but some technique in order that the energy that has been released is not dissipated, because you require that energy. You require that energy in order to program. The program which you are going to give to the brain, for that you need energy, and that is why release the energy by the visualization of the pleasant things. Having found that energy, see to it that it is not dissipated. And one simple method of seeing this is the pranayama about which I spoke. Having done this, you will have energy to direct the program which you want to have. The program may be with regard to health or with regard to anything that is worrying you so far as your life is concerned. You will be free to direct that energy to that particular program which you have in mind. I have not followed. Yes. Yeah. No. Whether conditioned or not conditioned, if you indulge, then the purpose for which you have visualized is not served. Your purpose in using the visualization technique is to come to the solution of certain problems. But if you get indulged, then you are not able to use this energy. This energy may become wasted, or it may remain without any use whatsoever. We are interested in using that energy. And if we want to use that energy for facing certain problems, certain difficult situations, then it cannot be done if you go on indulging. That is all. I'm not saying that indulging is wrong. I'm saying that it will not serve the purpose for which you have released that energy. Yes? What are the lessons? But we are without energy. So we need energy even in order to understand why we are this way or why we are not this way. Even this is a problem. And for all problems we need energy. This is the way of releasing energy, that's all. Utilize that energy for whatever purpose you like. And if you indulge, then the energy gets wasted. And therefore there is no point in releasing that energy if it gets wasted. So shall we? All right, we... At 3 o'clock.